We will return then to the life and missionary labors of Reformed Baptist Abel Bingham. Now, we previously spoke of his 6 years of relentless labor and trials and persecutions, which he suffered among the Seneca Indians of New York. We spoke also of the blessing of the Lord on those missionary labors, which in due time brought forth much fruit. Now, in that first message, I gave you the sources that I use. I like to do that. We're very careful on our sources, and we compare them. We had a number of sources. There is no book on him. But with some research, we came up with a number of sources, including a fairly short biographical account by his daughters, and then a number of other sources as well. So we do have material to work with. And he had a journal. And during his time with the Seneca Indians, as you remember, he kept quite a few entries and quite a few days where he wrote things, not so much so among his many years with the Indians we're going to next. Now, at this point, we follow missionary Bingham and his family to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. In July of 1828, Abel was appointed by the Baptist Board of Foreign Missions, eventually known as the American Baptist Missionary Union, to begin a mission at Sault Ste. Marie as missionary to the Ojibwe Indians. Now, just for your own benefit, you may or may not know this, but Sault Ste. Marie, Sault, is actually spelled S-A-U-L-T. So if you see that, you won't say, well, where? That can't be the place. Must be Sault Ste. Marie. Must be spelled different, but that's how it's spelled. Now, if you look at a map to see where Sault Ste. Marie is, it's located on a sort of isthmus between three great lakes, Superior, Huron, and Michigan. And, of course, Superior is on our northern border, Wisconsin, and Michigan on the eastern border. So this location is where he was, and it was a good place for this mission to be headquartered because for generations, this had been a gathering place for the various bands of the Ojibwe, also known, eventually called the Chippewa Indians as well. Today, they're generally called Chippewa Indians. Now, once the white man had come to the Great Lakes area, French fur traders frequented the Sioux, as it was often called, just the Sioux as well. And the reason for the popularity of the place, well, of course, location. It was a very rich fishing grounds all around there. It was a natural place to gather then, not only for fishing, but for trading, because there was the three Great Lakes there. A lot of travel and exploration was done by the water, of course, these Great Lakes and rivers that connected them, and so on and so forth. And so it was also a strategic place militarily, of course, and prior to the time the Binghams arrived, a fort had been built and named Fort Brady. It was very strategic, both because of the lakes, but also because it was on the border with Canada. There is a Sault Ste. Marie in Canada as well. It's that close. Now, what about the Ojibwe Indians? Who are they? Well, the Indian nation, this particular one, was and is found in Michigan, Canada, and the northern part of Wisconsin. They, of course, are still in Wisconsin on reservations, those that choose to stay on the reservations, that is. And those who heard my presentation on the two pioneer missionaries to the Dakota Sioux Indians of Minnesota, the Pond Brothers, will remember that the Ojibwe and the Dakota were hereditary enemies. They carried on war with each other year after year after year, trading murder raids into each other's territory. I would call them murder raids because the favorite tactic of both sides was to watch a village, to go into the other one's territory stealthily, and watch a village, and when there were no men there that could defend it, they would be all off hunting, then they would attack it, and they would massacre the old men, the old people, the women, and the children. And then, of course, they would race for home, so to speak, as fast as they could, but then they were sure that it was going to be returned in kind, of course. And it went back and forth. Now, the Dakota Sioux had also once been located in Wisconsin, but the Ojibwe got firearms first. They got their firearms from the French, and they were able to drive them out of that area long before it was a state, of course. Now, upon receiving his appointment to Sault Ste. Marie and spending time in Boston to receive instructions from the board, Abel Bingham returned home to Western New York. As you remember from our first presentation, that was his home at that time. He went back to say goodbye to his friends and relatives and old neighbors, and he was ordained at that time. Leaving then his wife and children temporarily behind, Abel traveled to Buffalo, New York. And then on September 14th, 1828, he took passage on the schooner, the Lady of the Lake, under the command of a Captain Walker. In Detroit, he boarded the John Quincy Adams. There was a change there. If you look at the lakes, you'll see why, how they're set up with Erie and Huron and so forth. And he boarded the John Quincy Adams. That was under the charge of a Captain Charles Sunard. Now, the John Quincy Adams then arrived at Sault Ste. Marie on October 9th, 1828. Now, you think of that. It took from September 14th to October 9th, 1828. So it took a while, really, when you consider the lakes and how they're set up in that waterway, and yet it did take a little while to get there. Now, upon disembarking, Missionary Bingham reported first to the Indian agent, Henry Schoolcraft, and also to the commander of the garrison at Fort Brady, a Captain Wilcox, and the missionary was well received by both men. As for the Ojibwe, a very brief summary of some aspects of his mission work, which he wrote by request as his time in the mission field was drawing to a close. This was in 1855. It contains this from Abel Bingham. "I found the Indians in a very dark and ignorant state, attached to their Metowins, or medicine religion, and practicing a kind of sorcery by which their jugglers exerted much influence over their adherents." By jugglers, of course, he meant these that would, the idea is trick others. And it was the medicine men. He also mentions that he found those jugglers fond of using poison to kill those they viewed as adversaries, enemies, or competitors. Now, Reverend Bingham, in that same letter, wrote that the Ojibwe believed in a great spirit they described as merciful and kind, and also a very powerful evil spirit. Of Christian truth, he declared they were, quote, dark as night. Thanks to whiskey sold to them by greedy whites, the missionary also found the Ojibwe close, as he said, to being a nation of drunks. Now, having been instructed by the Board of Missions to make the Ojibwe his particular concern, but at the same time to take opportunities to minister to the white population, the garrison, and others who were in the area at any given time, Reverend Bingham immediately began a church service for both whites and Indians. One was in the morning on the Lord's Day, the other in the evening. And then shortly, a church was organized. It was a church which began with just six members. But by the grace of God, it just continued to grow under the preaching of Missionary Bingham. Now, having yet no knowledge of the Ojibwe language, the missionary secured the services of an interpreter named Miss Charlotte Johnson. Now, this was a very remarkable young woman. She was born at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan in 1806 to an Ojibwe woman whose name translated into English was Green Prairie Woman. Her father was a fur trader by the name of John Johnson, hence the name Charlotte Johnson. She was the sister of the wife of the Indian agent Schoolcraft as well. Charlotte's Ojibwe name translated to English was the Woman of the Wild Rose. I cannot tell you when she converted to Christ. I do not have enough information on her. I believe there is a book on her, but I don't have it. So I don't know when she was born again. But from the accounts I have read, she appeared to be a very sincere and godly woman with a love for the Lord and for the lost. She worked as translator for missionary Abel Bingham during the years 1828 and 1829. After that, she continued on with missionary work among her people. In 1833, she married the Reverend Mr. McMurray. And so now Charlotte McMurray continued on in missionary work among the Ojibwe. She's not the subject of this presentation, so we'll leave her there. But I would simply say she did spend her whole life serving the Lord in missionary labor among her people, the Ojibwe. Now, another labor that missionary Bingham took up immediately upon arriving at the Sioux was a school for Indian children to educate them, and also, of course, to constantly be speaking to them of the things of the Lord. And by the grace of God, within a very short time, he had 57 students. Then after spending a number of months organizing the mission and the school and establishing church services, then in early spring, he strapped on snowshoes and he walked to Mackinac in order to take passage on a vessel to New York State. I say he walked to Mackinac, but there was a short stretch of water, too, that he would have had to get across. But that was 62 miles away. These were sturdy people. Now, the purpose of the voyage that he was taking was to bring his family back to Sault Ste. Marie, get them settled in, and then begin in earnest what was going to be a very wide-ranging, aggressive ministry among the Ojibwe of Michigan, Canada, and Wisconsin. Through all of his years as a missionary and a pastor, it had been and was a consistent practice of Abel Bingham to avoid unnecessary division among true brethren. They maybe didn't belong to the same denomination as he, the same church, but if they were true brethren, he labored to have fellowship with them and not cause unnecessary division. But he always practiced scriptural separation where faithfulness demanded it, such as, of course, concerning Roman Catholic priests, and they were up around there as missionaries, or unfaithful Protestants of any denomination. At Mackinac, Reverend Bingham, Reformed Baptist, of course, had very warm fellowship with Presbyterian missionaries there, including a pastor, Ferry, F-E-R-R-Y. Of this, Abel wrote, "Our friendly intercourse and Christian fellowship was never marred while we remained at that frontier." The whole time he was there on the mission field. "And we felt as much at home at each other's stations as if we belonged to the same denomination. I sat with them in session while examining candidates for church membership, delivered the preparatory lecture previous to communion." That was during his visit there. Missionary Bingham returned from the East with his family July 11, 1829. Hannah kept a diary, but I only have two entries. I would like to see more. To get more, there is a way, but it's a process to get copies through a historical society in Michigan. But I do have just two entries, but they are good entries or as far as time-wise, because they are from when the Binghams, this is wife Hannah and the children, arrived at Sault Ste. Marie when he brought them back. One is dated July 11, 1829, and the other dated July 12, 1829. So I say these are the only diary entries I have, but I want to read them. The only diary entries from Hannah Bingham. But I want to read them because I think they reveal a good deal about this choice saint. We have this, St. Mary's River, Saturday, July 11, 1829. "After being tossed over the Huron for 3 days, we came into the river yesterday morning and now are safely moored in this pleasant river not far from our long-sought-for home, where we can see mountains, rocks, and islands with their beautiful green, and the birds, too, are sweetly singing around the shore. I have been considerably seasick, but feeling in good spirits this morning. I have had two sleepless nights, last evening especially, but generally have slept well. The appearances of the natives yesterday affected me considerably, though not so much from their savage looks as from the description the inhabitants give of their, the white inhabitants, of their being a barbarous, wicked people. But this is what I must expect. I may yet enjoy many a sweet hour with even the poor outcasts, The sweet morning comes and sweeps away gloom. The idea that God is calling us here and that He is everywhere present makes our future prospects, even in this secluded spot, appear pleasant. Then we have Sault Ste. Marie, Sunday evening, July 12, 1829, Sabbath evening. We came about a dozen miles yesterday in an open boat against the wind and tide, and with some difficulty reached Sault Ste. Marie, a little before night. Mr. Hulbert opened his doors to receive us, one they stayed with for a brief time. Although we had to leave many of our things and were not well prepared for the Sabbath, yet I felt happy and nothing troubled me. Our concerns for God had blessed us in bringing us safely to this heathen shore. Today is a beautiful one, not a cloud to be seen. But what makes it more beautiful is that it is God's day, and I have been permitted to go to His house for worship, first with the citizens and then with the Indians. It was indeed a feeling time with me to see them flocking in to hear the gospel, and to see them so ignorant of the way of life and salvation affected my heart. Truly, I said within my heart, the time to favor Zion is now a-coming, and the poor Chippewa are about to receive the precious treasure. As I said, they are revealing diary entries. And this is from a woman that had already been on the mission field and suffered much, literally suffered much, even the loss of one child. And she actually lost two at a young age on the mission field and not entirely, how would I say this? In part probably because of the hardships. And she was sick quite a bit back in New York, and they had had so much persecution, as you well know, even from government officials. And listen to her as she writes in the diary. Along with his large family, Abel Bingham brought several carpenters from Detroit to build a large mission house, which served as a dwelling place for the Binghams, also a boarding school for Indian children and a day school for the children of American station there in the area of the Sioux, as well as for French, Indian, and mixed breed children. The boarding school was under the charge of Hannah Bingham, Reverend Bingham's wife. She's a hardworking woman. And the Binghams moved into the mission house on November 16th, 1829. Now, here I would just note that the Sault Ste. Marie mission was very hard-pressed for financial resources virtually at all times, and the Binghams themselves were more often than not on the verge of poverty. The area itself was also no easy place to live in, as you can imagine, certainly not in those days. The winters, of course, were very long and cold, with the temperatures at times hitting lows of 30 and 40 degrees below zero. Now, we live in Wisconsin. We know we're far south of the Sault Ste. Marie, but yet we know what it's like to live sometimes long, hard winters with temperatures down where overnight it can be sub-zero. You get a stiff wind blowing, and it's pretty frigid. But it was even colder there. I certainly grew up on a farm and was a farmer many years and had to do a lot of work outside in the winter. And sometimes it was down where it was sub-zero and the wind was blowing. So when I think of that, and then I think of what they did in those days, in that climate, and I certainly admire the commitment and the tenacity of both Hiram, I should say Abel, and Hannah Bingham, in light of their many years of service in that region of the country. And as we're going to be speaking of, certainly with regard to the far-ranging missionary journeys of Abel Bingham at all times of year, and we'll share a little bit on that in a moment. There was a missionary, Hiram Bingham, as well. I believe he went to the Sandwich Islands or Hawaii, if I'm not mistaken. Now, there's so many little things that we might take for granted, not so little even, that they couldn't take for granted. And then there are important things, too, that we take for granted that they couldn't. For instance, mail. We take that for granted. The mail comes. Go get the mail. It wasn't like that, obviously, at Sault Ste. Marie. The mail came there once a month at the most. How did it get there? It had to be brought from Saginaw, Michigan. Now, in the winter, I say, because ice would make navigation impossible. The Great Lakes do get ice along the shores, and sometimes ice grows well out, and there have been times when they've frozen over. And so ice would make navigation impossible in the winter. So they had to get the mail, they had to go 250 miles, whoever went to get the mail. And they had to go in the winter with dog teams and snowshoes. So I remember being told by my father, go get the mail. A little bit harder the way they had to go get the mail. If I would have had to go 250 miles with a dog team and snowshoes, it would have been a little more serious than run to the end of the driveway, obviously, and a lot harder. Now, the first Ojibwe Indian which missionary Bingham became acquainted with was a minor chief named Shigud. This man, though, he was not the first convert, but he eventually came to Christ. And not only that, he became a deacon in the church that Bingham organized and which had both white and Indian members. The first lost sinner won to Christ, though, was this through the labors of Abel Bingham, was a 60-year-old woman who had been notorious for her heathen ways and her drunkenness, a very evil woman. But through the preaching of Abel Bingham, the Spirit of the Lord brought her to conviction and faith in Christ. And for the rest of her days, this woman was known to the whites as the old native sister. 60 years old when she came to Christ. I will not pronounce or try to pronounce her long Indian name, but we are going to meet up with her again a little bit later here. Now, as mentioned earlier, drinking and drunkenness was common among the Indians. In the early stage of his work, the missionary formed a temperance union. He believed in total abstinence. Now, perhaps someone would say he should just stick to his preaching. This was an obstacle to the gospel, this drinking. Have you ever tried to share the gospel with a drunk? And plus, it was just bondage to these Indians. And we Christians, we care about souls, we care about the whole person. And so he formed this temperance union. He wanted to see the Indians not only saved, but he wanted to see them civilized, if you will. Not that civilized men don't drink, but he wanted to see their condition greatly improved, of course. In the early stages of his work, then he formed this temperance union, and he had help in that by several principal men of the fort. The first four signers of the constitution of this temperance union were the commanding officer of Fort Brady, the second in command, the doctor, and the sutler, the one that sold the supplies in the fort. And that man stood to lose money because he could make money selling whiskey, but he signed anyway. The four also were the first to sign the abstinence pledge themselves. So here, too, it would appear the Lord was at work. Now, Indians who couldn't sign their name to that pledge made their mark instead. Upon being urged by the Reverend Bingham to quit his drinking and sign the pledge, Kabanodin, the chief of the Tequamanon band of Ojibwe, declared, quote, "If my mouth was sewed up and my legs tied, I might keep from drinking." But the missionary continued to press the chief to give up his drunken ways and sign the pledge. In due time, he did just that, and he was forever true to the pledge he gave. Now, throughout his missionary labors, Abel Bingham continued to fight against the drinking of alcoholic beverages and against those whites who sold whiskey to the Indians. In this two-front battle, he achieved great success. Through his diligence, through his perseverance, through his aggressiveness, he was an aggressive man in a good way. Another duty the missionary took on was visiting the sick at the hospital to comfort and witness to them. And the captain of the fort was very greatly interested in the work of missionary Bingham. And so he asked him to hold church services right in the soldiers' barracks and go right into their barracks and preach to them. And the missionary did it. And a number of soldiers were converted to Christ and they joined the mission church. It was said that a revival of sorts commenced at this time, and consequently the church began to grow more. Having begun in 1830 with six members, by 1833 it consisted of some 50 baptized members, including Indians and whites, some of them soldiers. And here it ought to be noted, though, when we say baptized members, Pastor Bingham was very cautious about not baptizing too soon and making members of the church and having them at the Lord's table. He was cautious, as is right, but the church continued to slowly, steadily grow. I mean, it was a spiritual battle, as we would know it would be, but the progress was made. Eventually, that fort's complement of soldiers was transferred to a fort at Chicago. So he lost all these men, but did he lose them? Or did the Lord have another plan? First of all, other soldiers came in. He started preaching to them and winning soldiers for the Lord. But secondly, the first complement, several companies of soldiers, was sent to a military installation in Chicago. What did they do? They organized a church there. That was the beginning of the very first Baptist work in that city, a Reformed Baptist work at that. Meanwhile, Abel Bingham continued to preach then to the new complement of soldiers, and by the grace and power of the Lord, began to lead some to Christ. And then there was another important development we would just note here. The fort's army surgeon, Dr. Edwin James, was stirred with a very deep concern for the spiritual welfare of the Ojibwe. So this moved him to undertake, he was a very educated man, to put it that way, it moved him to undertake, with the help of Abel Bingham, a translation work of the New Testament into Ojibwe, or Chippewa, the Chippewa language, Ojibwe or Chippewa language. That New Testament was then printed in 1833. Now, this isn't to suggest that literacy was widespread among the Ojibwe, because it was not, but as individual Indians began to read, learn how to read, they had a Bible in their own language. And then in the boarding school, the Indian children were also taught the English language. It's easier to teach children a language, and they were taught the English language, so they had the English and the Ojibwe language, but there was an Ojibwe Bible now, too, as the adults began to learn to read that language as it was reduced into a written language. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Sault Ste. Marie and the area around it was not only the home for many Indians, but a great many congregated. Other Indians came there at various times, and so there was plenty of Indians to preach to. But Missionary Bingham wasn't content to witness for Christ and preach the gospel only to those who came to the Sioux. He early on established a very far-reaching preaching circuit, far-ranging preaching circuit, in the area around Lake Huron, Lake Superior, and northern Lake Michigan. He also carried the gospel to the Indians north of the lakes in the Canadian wilderness around those two lakes, Huron and Superior. And he continued those missionary journeys year in, year out, during his 27 years among the Ojibwe. Now, he spent most of those hours, most of those journeys were in Michigan and Wisconsin, some were in Canada, but he would seek out Indian villages and encampments. He would hear of one here or encampment here that he would come across as they moved around, and he would find them. And he visited Indians even on islands. He heard there's an encampment here, a small gathering there, a settlement there, and he would go out onto the islands and the lakes. So in the summer, he made use of a small boat or canoes, and then also traveled much on foot. And so he made repeat visits then, as time wore on, to Ojibwe bands that he had already been to. He would come back, preach more, teach further. And then he would always be seeking out new groups, new bands, new encampments, where he could preach there as well to those he had never preached to. In these journeys, he carried medicines with them to help the Indians that way, and he carried his temperance pledge as well to speak to them about that, to give up those evil ways. Now, in that harsh winter weather then, summer's one thing. It had its challenges. It had its discomforts. It had its dangers. But then you have the harsh winter weather of that region. And you have temperatures not infrequently getting below zero, of course, sometimes down to 40 degrees below, sometimes with wind and snow very common, especially around those lakes. in that kind of weather, of course, the missionary traveled on snowshoes, and he had a dog train carrying his supplies, and then he'd have an Indian helper, possibly two, with him. During the winter, fording streams on the ice could sometimes be dangerous. And then sometimes, of course, fording streams was very miserable. When a stream was not entirely frozen over yet, it might be early in the winter, or sometimes it was just later on in the winter, but the stream was so swift, the missionary would have to take off his moccasins, wade through the freezing cold water, at times up to his knees or higher. And not just once, because he and his Indian helper would then go back and forth carrying the dogs one by one and all the supplies. Apparently the dogs just weren't about to voluntarily jump into freezing water like the missionary was willing to, for a much higher reason, of course. Now, the missionary took most of his supplies with him. One would think, well, couldn't he eat at some of these Indian villages? Couldn't he eat at these encampments he visited? Well, they were not generally very well provisioned, and the people were themselves poor. So Reverend Bingham, though he ministered the gospel, the bread of life, to the Indians, he also, at the same time, did not want to take from them their physical bread. He did not want to take from their meager stores of food. So instead of them sharing with him, he gave them spiritual bread, and them giving him, of course, of their carnal things, as we think of a particular scripture text, he would give them food for their bodies as well. And in addition, he sought to teach them ways and methods to then improve their temporal status so they wouldn't be so poverty-stricken, because they just lived day by day. And if they didn't have good hunting or good fishing, then they were in trouble. And in the winter, food supplies would get stretched out, and they would be sometimes a near starving state. So he shared with them ways to improve their situation. He did the same with the Ojibwe around Sault Ste. Marie. Primarily, he gave them instruction in agriculture, in farming, if you will, in growing their own food. He certainly did not discourage them from continuing on in their fishing, trapping, and hunting endeavors, but he shared with them how to grow and why they should begin to grow things and think about having a permanent settlement. And some did begin to do just that, and more, in fact, as the years rolled on. And they developed good producing fields of turnips, squash, and potatoes. Now, maybe I'm too farmer-minded yet to bring this up, but the soil and the climate up there is just not good for raising corn. That's a real staple crop, but it's just not. The growing season isn't long enough. You can't grow a good amount of corn, and the soil's not really suited for it. Now, during the winter, as in other times of the year, the missionary and his helper or helpers would, of course, camp under the stars when they were on the road, so to speak, when they were going from one place to another. Now, in the winter, the summer, that's one thing. In the winter, it meant making a bed in the snow. And they would spend their evenings under the stars. Before they turned in, they would spend their time singing, praying, and speaking of the things of the Lord to each other before lying down to sleep. The well-known Ojibwe Methodist preacher, maybe not well-known these days, but at one time he was, Ojibwe preacher Reverend Peter Marksman, testified that as a young boy, he first heard the gospel from Abel Bingham in 1830. He was just a small boy, and the missionary visited his village. Or he came to the Sioux, perhaps. I'm trying to remember which it was. But he was from Wisconsin. Peter was the given English name of this Ojibwe, and Marksman was his Indian name translated into English. And it meant just that, an Indian, Marksman. Eventually they called him that because he was such a good shot. But this preacher, eventual preacher, was born in northern Wisconsin on an island in the St. Croix River. You know where that is. It's in the northwestern part of the state. Born on an island there. His father was a medicine man. You know how evil that is. Those men were evil. And also a chief of a band of Ojibwe Indians. The Ojibwe medicine men practice healing arts. and also necromancy and other heathen religious rites, of course. As I say, I believe he actually maybe, as the other Ojibwe did, his family had come to the Sault Ste. Marie. He may have heard the gospel there. But I do believe that Abel Bingham also, I read an account of him visiting and coming right into their lodge and preaching the gospel to the Marksman family. So it may have been both. But at any rate, this future preacher first heard the gospel from the lips of Abel Bingham. And I believe the father of Peter Marksman also did come to Christ in time as well. Now, in 1830, in addition to all of this labor at Sault Ste. Marie that he was doing, he traveled around on his missionary journeys about 800 miles. Now, that did not decrease. That only increased as far as this travel. In fact, increased quite a bit some years. In 1829, a Miss Cynthia Brown joined the mission as an assistant teacher. And then in 1830, as the school developed more and more children to teach, both Indian and white, two more young women joined the mission to work also as teachers in this growing mission school. I just wanted to mention them. Their names were Miss Mary Rice and Miss Eleanor McComber. I just want to mention them because they were dedicated. Some of these, they get forgotten. There's a great many young women went out and dedicated their lives to the mission work. Now, because of some health problems, Miss McComber soon resigned her position, but you might find this interesting, those of you who have read a good many missionary biographies about mission work in various parts of the world, and certainly during the great century of missions, Miss McComber was restored to health, and then she accepted an appointment to labor for the Lord in Burma among the Karen people. And then another godly young woman came to Sault Ste. Marie to teach in a mission school, Miss Lydia Lillybridge. She consequently ended up sailing to Burma in the company of the missionary Adoniram Judson and his third, which was his last wife, Emily. As you perhaps know, Judson's first two wives both laid down their lives on the mission field of Burma. Now, yet another young woman who began her missionary labors with the Binghams in 1842, these young women came there, started there, learned much, and then went on to other places. And so there, too, you see Hannah and Abel being used of the Lord, even there, for the good of people, for instance, in Burma, the lost in Burma. But another young woman came there in 1842, I say to Sault Ste. Marie. She entered the mission field eventually, serving faithfully in Siam, but then eventually coming back home to serve in a mission to the Delaware Indians. Then also a son and a daughter, two of the children anyway, of Abel and Hannah, also spent time laboring with their parents in the Ojibwe mission work. Now, there were Roman Catholic missionary priests operating in the area around the Great Lakes at that time as well. These followers of the Pope labored to undermine and interfere with Reverend Bingham. Now, that's an old story, isn't it? That was a common thing, and it still is in certain parts of the world. Christian missionaries being attacked verbally, being undermined by Romish priests doing all they can to put obstacles in their way, turn the people against them. This is what was going on in that area with regard to the labors of Reverend Bingham. But for his part, Reverend Bingham was no shrinking violet. He wasn't shy about crossing spiritual swords with Rome's emissaries. We do remember from the first presentation, this was the man that in 1814 was Lieutenant Bingham, who was shot in the head or hit in the head in battle, taken off the field for dead, came to with a fractured skull, had it wrapped up, and went back to the fight. So he wasn't too shy. He was now a soldier of the cross. And it was said he especially rejoiced. He rejoiced when anyone was saved, but he especially rejoiced whenever he was instrumental in leading a Roman Catholic to Christ and out of the darkness and bondage of popery. Now we have, as we think of his battles with Romish priests, and there were a number of them, we would share here one such battle. It's recorded by the Baptist History and Heritage Organization. It's quite long, but I think you might enjoy it. Bingham's most furious encounter over religious differences occurred with an unnamed Jesuit at Sault Ste. Marie in 1834. He, that's Abel Bingham, visited the home of a sick man. This is a man he had gone to many times and shared the gospel and spoke to him. And the priest ordered him out. Then the following happened. This is Bingham's own words. I let him know that I was in a free country and I should do as I pleased about that. He wished to know what I was there for. I told him because I pleased to come and visit my neighbor. He said if I wished to visit him as a neighbor and bring none of my books, because he had brought pamphlets and he had brought a Bible, of course. I replied I should bring what books I pleased and the man might do as he pleased about reading them. He, as the priest, seized a tract and went to the fire under pretense of flinging it into the fire. I paid no particular attention to it and did not rise from my seat. He finally turned about and flung it at me. It fell on the floor near me and I picked it up. He afterward came to me and demanded I give it to him again. I declined. He seized it, apparently determined to wrest it from me. I did not give it up, but firmly said to him, "Do act like a gentleman, if you can act like a Christian." Then he let go of the book, but soon laid hold of the Testament, which I held in my hand. He had a New Testament there. It was actually in French. I believe this was a French-speaking man. There were French around the Great Lakes, of course. Which I held in my hand as if determined to, he sees it as if determined to wrest from me, but I did not see fit to give that up. So they were having quite a wrestling match, apparently. By this time, he became considerably enraged and declared that it was the word of the devil, that I was deceived and a deceiver, a wolf, and my books were a lie, and ordered me off. I replied, if I am deceived, why don't you come to me like a Christian, because they call themselves Christians, he obviously didn't think he was one, and show me wherein I am deceived, and try to undeceive me. He was inviting him to a disputation there, and gave him to understand that if he wanted to come to me in a right spirit, I would hear and converse with him freely and familiarly. The priest was in a fury, and Bingham stopped talking to him. He turned to the sick man and asked him if he had always been treated kindly and in a Christian manner. He replied that he had. Bingham then said how sorry he was that he had disturbed the man, the priest had disturbed him, and that he had come to visit him with his usual feelings of kindness and charity. Apparently, the priest never stopped shouting, and Bingham said, quote, that he and I should by and by meet at the judgment seat of Christ, and there would be known who of us were wolves and who were sheep. The priest eventually left, but they encountered each other a few days later, and according to Bingham, the priest shoved his interpreter aside and entered the lodge with a cudgel, with a club. But we don't know what happened next. Maybe Abel Bingham just left that out. No, I don't know. Now, the year 1835 saw a good deal of ground gained for the Lord, and there were reasons to rejoice. But it was also apparently a year of hardship and struggle. In one of his few journal entries, and they are shorter than when he was in New York ministering to the Seneca, but in one of his few journal entries, for that year, 1835, he wrote, at present our mission is enveloped in clouds of darkness. So there were many struggles. The 1836 annual report of the government, the U.S. government's Commissioner of Indian Affairs, includes a section on the Bingham mission that concludes with, there are strong inducements to the teachers, Bingham and his assistants, to persevere in their benevolent labors. Some of them, the Ojibwe, have died examples of piety, and a considerable number are strictly temperate, leading consistent, orderly lives and making proper use of their annuities. You know what the annuities were, right? When the Indians would sell their land and take a reservation, then they would be paid year by year money for selling their lands. They actually got paid. Now, of course, Indians would sell their land sometimes because they knew they might as well. They're going to lose them anyway. But they were given money, and they were given this year by year instead of all at once because they would have just would have been gone. And they just continued to give them these payments. The 1838 by going back to making proper use of the annuities, that was good. That was an advance right there. They weren't spending it all of it on whiskey and things like this. The 1838 report, the annual report of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, includes this excerpt on the mission school at Sault Ste. Marie. With the exception of the mission's ever-present financial difficulties, things progress well. And it goes on to talk about one particular student who had now graduated and was a blacksmithing apprentice. So he was taking on a vocation. In 1838, Abel Bingham accepted an appointment as chaplain of Fort Brady. He already had his church, but now he's the chaplain of Fort Brady, so he added that to his already heavy workload. The church he founded under Christ and pastored continued to grow, as did the school, and one of the constants of his labors continued to be his visiting of nearby Indian villages and homes, and then also going out on those far-ranging missionary trips, which were not infrequently fraught with much hardship and great peril. And we will give you an example of that. And it is a fairly lengthy example, but I think it would be a good thing to do as just, as I say, an example of what this man faced, not just once, but over and over and over. In the dead of winter, January 1842, missionary Bingham set out for Grand Island, about 150 miles distant from the Sioux, taking with him an Indian guide and a young Ojibwe to help as an interpreter as needed. He was on one of his missionary journeys. As we mentioned earlier, he made those journeys year-round. Well, on this particular journey, there happened to be a short midwinter thaw. Now, that brought the temperatures up some, at least in a day, so they weren't so frigid, but it brought other problems with it. It was only for a short time. Now, the young man with the missionary, I would just note, was a mission boy who had come to the mission and had been schooled there. His name was Henry. He had now an English name, if you will, Shegod. You remember earlier that chief that became the deacon? So how this young man was related, I don't know, to that chief, but perhaps his son, same name. Now, concerning this missionary journey, we would offer this. This is from the Journal of Abel Bingham, quite a long entry. Spent 2 days with the Indians at Tequamanon, holding services as usual. Snow had fallen during our stay, making heavy traveling for the dogs, who could go but a short distance without stopping. So there's a thaw, so it's a heavy snow, and there was quite a bit of it. Did not reach Whitefish Point the first day. Feared our provisions would give out and felt almost inclined to return. But next morning, after making a portage, I know the French that hear this will say portage, but I say portage. Across the point, which lessened the distance, we found the traveling better, took courage and pressed ahead. Third day came to a beautiful bay at the mouth of the Grand Marie River, 90 miles from the Sioux. Being rainy, the ice was covered with water, through which we had to wade the whole distance across. That must have been nice, wading in ice water a long distance. Next morning passed the Grand Sab, or Great Sand Banks, stretching along the shore some 8 or 9 miles, nearly perpendicular, and from 50 to 150 feet in height. The curious stacks of ice that had been formed by the relentless motion of the Great Superior on one side and the huge banks on the other side presented as grand and sublime a view as imagination could paint. The heavy surf from the broad lake rolled in with awful majesty and dashed with tremendous force against the massive rocks. After passing the pictured rocks, we ascended the ledge and encamped in a small ravine. We were within 12 or 14 miles of the island, but could pass no further on the ice or beach, the lake not being frozen at this point, so we must take to the woods. The traveling was so rough and uneven, we were obliged to leave our dog train, oilcloth, buffalo robe, and oilcloth overcoat, let the consequences be what they might, strapped our provisions on our backs and continued our march till we came upon a hunter's camp, so recently deserted that the embers were still alive, and found by our compass that we were lost. I felt much uneasiness and concern. Took my Bible and read the 41st, 42nd, and 43rd Psalm, which were the first that presented themselves. The word both reproved and comforted me. Spent the Sabbath here and held divine service, preached to an audience of one through an interpreter. Monday, retraced our steps, descending a ledge of rocks into a deep ravine, and made two or three unsuccessful attempts to climb the opposite bank. If we could not find a pass up this precipice, we must return without visiting the island, which would be very unfortunate, as we were now limited to one meal a day. My interpreter cast off his pack and snowshoes, commenced climbing, and in a few minutes sung out, "Here is a place I think we can pass." There was a small protuberance, somewhat resembling a man's nose, with perpendicular rocks on both sides of great height. If you can picture this in the winter and the ice and the snow and the straight up rock. And here we descended the ledge by letting ourselves down from bush to bush and found ourselves on Lake Superior again within 3 miles of the lodges. It was excessively cold with a severe headwind so that my ear caps and handkerchief both tied over my ears. I froze one of them, growing that distance, one of his ears, he means. At 2 o'clock, found ourselves comfortably seated in, should I give this a try, Wazawadon's Lodge. I might have been close. Who was expecting us Saturday. Mr. Williams, an American living on the island, received us with great kindness and fed our dogs, which were nearly starved while going through the woods. He also furnished us with provisions and everything necessary for our return journey. While there, held meetings at the lodges, the various Indian lodges, and at Mr. W.'s house. Arrived at home much fatigued. Was absent 27 days. Preached 14 discourses, camped 16 nights in the woods, and was detained one day by severe weather. So truly, this man's life as a missionary was filled with much and hard labors. Certainly like the Apostle Paul, he was in journeyings, often in perils of water, 2 Corinthians 11:26. Also subject to other natural dangers, such as storms, frigid cold, the possibility of being lost in the wilderness, and danger from wolves. As with the apostle on his missionary journeys, Abel Bingham in his missionary journeyings was often in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, and hunger. And missionary Bingham also was at times in perils by the heathen, as the apostle Paul was, if not to the same extent and frequency. Throughout his years at Sault Ste. Marie, he had been warning the Indians of the dangers of alcoholic beverages, encouraging them to totally abstain, take the pledge. In 1842, he wrote, "In my labors as a missionary, I have felt it to be an important part of my duty to disseminate temperance principles as extensively and effectually as possible, and I have, since the 1st of November last," so this is 1842, he started this right at the start, "just since November last, obtained 60 Indian signatures to the temperance pledge, a pledge of teetotal abstinence from all intoxicating liquor. And I can truly say that it afforded me great satisfaction to witness the general firmness of those who signed the pledge when they came in contact with the temptations of the place." Also, the missionary early on had exerted pressure on the government to revoke the licenses of any traders who provided liquor to the Indians. And then the Indian Department did indeed produce a document to circulate among the traders to tell them that's exactly what would happen. They would have their licenses revoked if they were caught giving or trading or selling liquor to the Indians. So that was a great help. In 1844, some of the Ojibwe of Sault Ste. Marie in that area asked missionary Bingham to help them establish a permanent town. This would be to their great benefit as to their condition, of course. The place was called Taquamenon, and he agreed to do it. He drafted a document titled Articles of Agreement between the Baptist Mission of Sault Ste. Marie and the Ojibwe of Taquamenon. The mission agreed to pay, or to give, I should say, $150 to the Ojibwe to help construct permanent homes there under the supervision of the missionary. And then the Indians had to pledge themselves to, quote, "maintain a sober, quiet, religious settlement, keep away from the influence, the evil influence of intoxicating liquors, and listen to the gospel from the missionary." Abel Bingham, of course, was a very stalwart preacher. as you no doubt have discerned here. His aim was to please God rather than to be a pleaser of men. He had a constant, fervent love for the lost, but his first supreme love was for the Lord. And so consequently, he not only was steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord and not willing to compromise the word of the Lord, but he had enemies. He made enemies, white and red. We want to tell you just a little bit about one such enemy. His daughters tell about it. This particular man, and what we're about to share with you is from them. They tell about, in that brief account of Abel Bingham's life, they tell about a white man taken captive by the Ojibwe as a child and raised as an Indian. His English name was John Tanner. Well, this Tanner then married a white woman, but he treated his wife with absolute brutality. He was in the area of the Sioux there. In 1846, then, Reverend Bingham, along with Indian agent Schoolcraft, Henry Schoolcraft, and some sympathetic army officers from the fort, helped this woman take refuge with her family in Dearborn, since her life was very obviously in peril. And for this, Tanner vowed he would kill the missionary. The missionary is where he had all of his anger on that man, that missionary, said he would kill him. And he not only threatened his life, but then on one occasion, he snuck into the house Bingham was studying, and he came up behind him and assaulted him. He was also angry with Henry Schoolcraft, the Indian agent. And at one point in Abel Bingham's presence, John Tanner threatened to kill the children of Schoolcraft's sister. He was a very evil man. For that, then, Reverend Bingham had Tanner arrested and imprisoned until he promised to amend his ways. Well, he didn't amend his ways. He said he would. Upon being released, he killed several of the cattle belonging to missionary Bingham. These are people on the edge of poverty at all times. That was a heavy, terrible loss for the Bingham family. Then on Saturday night, July 4th, 1846, Tanner burned down his own house, set it up to make it look like he had perished in the fire. He then took his rifle and went hunting for Abel Bingham. Someone next spotted him sitting in an ambush near the Bingham house. But before Tanner had a chance to kill the missionary, the brother of the Indian agent that he was also angry at, James Schoolcraft, came by that thicket coming from somewhere else, and he was gunned down. Now, it would appear that Tanner saw the passing of Schoolcraft's brother as an opportunity for revenge that he didn't want to pass up, even though he wanted Bingham in the worst way. Now, at the time, it seemed obvious Tanner was the killer, but he has his, nowadays you can always find things like this, he has his champions. There's always someone that makes a villain a hero, of course, and there are claims that consequently after the killing, someone else confessed to it. I don't know if that's true or not. But certainly it's a very strange thing if Tanner left that thicket where he was sitting with a rifle and murder in his heart, and then he left and another man quickly replaced him in order to then gun down that other man. Seems strange to me. But at any rate, with this vicious, vindictive, violent man on the loose, this murderous man breathing threats against Abel Bingham, his most hated of enemies, the missionary's friends, urged Reverend Bingham to leave the area until Tanner was apprehended. The missionary's reply was characteristic of the man, quote, "I have never yet deserted my post in time of danger and will not now." This being the case, the officers from the fort that had a great, of course, respect, regard, and affection for the man and his work, posted an armed guard at the Bingham home. But, of course, Abel wasn't at that home all the time. But they did that every night for several months. Tanner, in the meanwhile, disappeared. No one knew where he was. He wasn't a very popular man with all he had done, of course. But he disappeared. And then eventually word came back from an Indian band that he had come among them, and they said, quote, "After a few moons passed away," that is, died. They didn't say if he had any help doing it or not. "After a few moons passed away." But, as is the case with so many Christian missionaries in so many places, as we mentioned earlier, the Roman Catholic priests continued to spare no effort to undermine the gospel ministry of Reverend Bingham, including by slandering him to the Indians, whom he sought to win for Christ, even as they sought to win those same Indians for the Pope. In one of the relatively few journal entries he made during his years of labor among the Ojibwe, we have this one from mid-February 1848. In it, he speaks of a Romish priest warning the Indians that he, Bingham, spoke nothing but lies. And then further, Bingham had this written: "I am informed that the Catholic priest for the Indians is disclaiming against me in every direction. But I belong to Christ. I must expect to have my name cast out as evil, especially by those who bear the anti-Christian mark or the mark of the beast. The priest is exerting himself to the utmost to bring the Indian children to his baptism." Also in 1848, our great spiritual adversary received reinforcements, with the Mormons planting a colony on Beaver Island in Lake Michigan. That island is about 75 miles from Sault Ste. Marie, as the crow flies. So with Abel Bingham's far-ranging missionary circuits, he was bound to come in contact with the Mormons, and he did. In fact, he entered into quite a debate with a Mormon who he encountered and who confronted him, and he, the Mormon, I mean, you know they're very missionary-minded themselves. But by his knowledge of the scriptures, it's reported that Reverend Bingham completely confounded the man. He knew his Bible, and he confounded the man, and he certainly gave him a good deal to think about. Now, we don't know, but what that Mormon became in time, a true follower of the Lord Jesus Christ, the true Lord Jesus Christ. By the end of the 1840s, there was not only a thriving mission church with a growing congregation of both white and Indian believers there at Sault Ste. Marie, and a thriving school there as well, and Indian converts at various points along missionary Bingham's far-flung preaching circuits. A number of the Ojibwe had certainly become sober, industrious, hardworking men and women. And the Christian Indians were entering into marriage rather than just simply living together, and they were seeking to please the Lord in their daily walk. But again, our great adversary, that roaring lion who walketh about seeking whom he may devour, still had many followers in that area, many workers encompassed by the mission field, that area encompassed by the mission field of Abel Bingham. And among those were heathen Indians, of course, the Roman Catholic priests, ungodly whites, and what we might call black market sellers of whiskey to the Indians, all of which despise missionary Bingham as their enemy. Now, around 1847, obviously we know Abel Bingham was able, by the grace of God, by the Spirit of the Lord, to lead many to Christ. But around 1847, he visited his very first convert, whose Ojibwe name, again, I just don't think I could pronounce it, but this is the woman which was led to Christ at the age 60, in which the whites had called the old native sister. The missionary found her in a needy condition, confined to her home, suffering intense pain from terrible rheumatism. Yet she is very content. This is some 20 years. She's approaching 80 or is 80. When she laid her eyes on Abel Bingham, the man who led her to Christ, it was said her whole face brightened up with joy. She told him she was never lonesome because, quote, she could pray herself into the hands of the Lord, as Abel Bingham wrote in his journal, the 9th of May, 1847. The following summer, in July, 1848, according again to the journal of the missionary, he was back in the area where this old Ojibwe saint lived, and he again visited her. By this time, his first Ojibwe convert, this one won to the Lord through the witness of Abel Bingham, was in a state of great suffering with the pain from her rheumatism and other ailments so bad as to cause her to be unable to keep from groaning whenever she was moved or she tried to move. Yet she urged the missionary to hold the preaching meeting in her home. The book Poor Low, Early Indian Missions, a Memorial, is one of several sources I've come across that contains a brief account of this event. Mr. Bingham found her on the point of death, 80 years of age, at her home some miles up the river from the mission. It was her request that the meeting to occur be held at her lodge so that she might hear the word. Accordingly, an awning was made of the sails of the boat before the door, and the exercises were conducted there. Her pathway brightened as she drew near her journey's end. A little before her death, noting a candle standing not far from her to give her light in the lodge, she said to her daughter, "You may move that candle, for I have light enough from above." Proverbs 18, verse 28, "For thou wilt light my candle, the Lord my God will enlighten my darkness." And Jesus said, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Abel Bingham, that faithful servant of the Lord, never slacked in his desire to win souls for Christ and do all the good he could for both red and white man of all ages. By the grace of God and for the great help of the missionary, he was married to a woman who was of like mind and heart and had the same work ethic. And so until his retirement from the mission field, but not from service to the Lord, in 1855, Reverend Bingham continued his faithful preaching and teaching in the pulpit and on his generally uncomfortable, sometimes painful, not infrequently dangerous, but greatly blessed of the Lord missionary journey, some of them now totaling hundreds of hard miles in length even. By the 1850s, the mission Abel Bingham headed up had planted two outstations, each about 150 miles from the Sioux, more fruit of Reverend Bingham's far-reaching missionary journeys. Also, another school was opened at a location about 25 miles from the mission home base, and a church service begun in yet another location in 1850. And then in 1851, missionary Bingham had the pleasure of preaching with one of the Ojibways who first heard the gospel from his lips, this one hearing it as a little boy. That individual was the Reverend Peter Marksman. They preached together. As the years wore on, the hospitable home of the Binghams was often visited by the great and the small there in the Sault Ste. Marie area. I say their home there. They were visited from people from all over. And all that came were not only welcome, but they could expect to hear a spiritual, a gospel exhortation from the head of the house when he was present. An army general, Cass, in charge of the U.S. government's dealing with the Indians, was a frequent guest of the Binghams, as were other army officers, enlisted men, and government officials. Who knows how the witness of the Binghams, both of them, as to their walk, and certainly as to what was shared with them from the word of the Lord, who knows how this affected so many others in the military, in the government, and so forth. Who knows what good fruit that bore, not only for the kingdom of God, but for citizens of this country, you might say. Officers of the British Army in Canada would come as well, and they found a warm welcome at the Bingham table. Among his English visitors were generals, earls, and lords who had come to see the work that was being done, perhaps out of curiosity. And certainly some were no doubt Christians. Others, it was a curiosity. They had heard, and they would find themselves seated at the Bingham table, these earls and lords and generals, side by side with Indians, Christian and heathen of all ages. Some of the distinguished guests made it their purpose to visit the mission, and they saw a great progress had been done, certainly among the Indians, certainly with the church and the school, and also the civilized habits now of the Indians. And yet, all those years, all through his years as a missionary to the Ojibwe and a preacher to both white and red men and women, the enemies of the Lord, red and white, labored to hinder his work, to even overthrow it, but in this they failed. They were not coming against the work of man, but against the work of the Lord. That no one can overthrow, no man. Now, we mentioned a number of times the dangers Abel Bingham faced during his missionary years at and course, from his base at Sault Ste. Marie, his journeys. Over the years, members of his family several times made visits to their family in New York. As we speak of dangers, these trips on the Great Lakes were not without some danger as well, as you well know. The Great Lakes weather can be very hazardous, can become that way in a very short time, at certain times of year especially. On one occasion in a November, Mrs. Bingham was on a trip east to the old home to see the folks, and she was in a shipwreck. She survived this shipwreck. It was near Thunder Bay on Lake Huron. The sailors were able to get the passengers into small boats and take them to a nearby island. On another occasion, some members of Abel's family also escaped a shipwreck. It's said it was a miraculous escape. When the ship they were on went down on Lake Erie with a great loss of life. But really, those trips themselves were perils of their missionary life. If they wouldn't have been in that mission on the frontier, they wouldn't have been on that trip, one of those infrequent trips back to see their family. In 1855, a number of the Ojibwe, Christian and otherwise, I should say by then, certainly in 1855, but by 1855, were settled in houses in permanent Indian villages. They still hunted and fished, but they also cultivated the land. And with these combined efforts, they had made a good deal of progress with regard to their ability to take care of their family. A good deal of credit for all those improvements has to be given to the missionary efforts of Abel Bingham and Hannah's wife, who diligently attended to her part of the work even as she raised their family. As he approached his 70th year, and with other missionaries on hand to take his place, Abel Bingham made the decision to retire from his active missionary labors into which he had entered, along with Hannah, 35 years previously. I don't know what all went into that decision, but from what I know of the man, he perhaps was getting to the point that these long missionary journeys were getting harder and harder. But he was not about maybe to give those up. If he couldn't do it all, if he couldn't give it his all, I might say, it would have been too hard for him to just give it part of what he wanted to give. But he had had many, many years and hard years in, and so had Hannah had many, many hard years. And so he approached his 70th year, and others were there to take over the work. He had entered into it 35 years previously, him and Hannah. And so they'd made that decision to retire from it. During those years, they had lived pretty much always in near poverty. They had suffered various illnesses. They had lost two young children. They had endured extreme weather conditions. As was spoken of in these two messages, they had endured animosity, in some case even murderous hatred of enemies of the gospel, such as John Tanner, of course, but also we think of corrupt government officials, as we think of the situation in New York with the Seneca. We think of the Seneca chief, Red Jacket, we told you about, his hatred for the gospel, although he was never saved. He was eventually, after a number of years, won over, but there was this murderous hatred for a number of years and threats. And we think of the apostates that came against the missionary and his wife, the atheists they had to contend with, the Romish priests, the sellers of whiskey to the Indians. We think of all these enemies and more. We remember Abel survived at least one assassination attempt, uncounted perils in the wilderness and on the water during missionary journeys. We think of Hannah and those other family members who were saved through two shipwrecks. Certainly, Abel and Hannah proved their love for the Lord and the lost. And just as surely, the Lord then richly blessed their missionary labors with much fruit. On October 22nd, 1855, the Binghams, along with one Indian girl, left Sault Ste. Marie and took ship to Grand Rapids, Michigan, the place where their youngest daughter, Mrs. J.C. Buchanan, lived. Here he then labored in preaching in the city and in small churches in nearby towns. characteristically doing all the good he could for the Lord, his people, and the lost, Hannah also continued on in service to the Lord, the two of them. All their Christian lives and in all their labors were as all Christians are urged to be, and they were, urged to be by the inspired apostle of Christ in his epistle to the Philippians, blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. Truly it was with Abel and Hannah, as is declared in Proverbs 4, verse 18. But the path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. In 1860, the Binghams purchased a home of their own. It was in that house that Abel gave his temporary farewell and dying blessing to his wife and a good many children and grandchildren present. Abel Bingham, known by many now as Father Bingham, known affectionately as Father Bingham, went to be forever with the Lord on November 26, 1865, at the age of 80. Hannah joined him in the presence of the Lord 3 years later, dying peacefully October 13, 1868, though it was thought that her death may have been hastened somewhat by the sudden death of her son, A.J. Bingham, 3 months earlier while on his way to visit her. In closing, I do not think we would do much better than to close by quoting from a short account of the life of Abel Bingham written by his daughters, as everything I've read of this man and his wife is in agreement with what they write here. All his life, he proved himself what he was, an heroic, unselfish Christian man, devoted to his duty and the good of others as it was made known to him. It needs to be understood that without the support of his equally unselfish and devoted wife, he would have been powerless. Cheerfully and without complaint, she followed him where duty seemed to lead, bore her full share of all their trials and privations, and was ever a helpmeet in the best sense of the term. In justice to Mr. Bingham, it should be said that his life work as a missionary among the Indians was purely a labor of love. He had devoted nearly all the proceeds derived from the sale of his farm to missionary purposes when he first entered upon his work, and in all these years he had never asked or received a separate salary for his support. He did not receive a pension, that would be from the government, until 11 years after being wounded for his army service pension, and for several years only a half pension, but had ever lived literally upon the promise which was so truly verified in his case. Trust in the Lord and do good, so shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Amen.